Asheville Free Media, ashevillefm.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm your host, Burst of Goodness. The Final Straw can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, and KWTF in Santa Rosa, California. The show is brought to you by the worker owners at Firestorm Books and Cafe at 48 Commerce Street in downtown Asheville, North Carolina, featuring organic coffee and milks, vegan sandwiches and wraps, homemade baked goods, radical literature, and a community calendar that can be found at www.firestormcafe.com. This week we're joined by Dr. George Katsifikas, the author of over a dozen books on social change and people's power movements. For decades, Dr. Katsifikas has been presenting these people's movements and their apparent synchronicities alongside other contemporary but distant movements in the framework of what he calls the Eros Effect. Most recently, Dr. Katsifikas has published a book a decade in the making through PM Press called South Korean Social Movements in the 20th Century, part one of a two-part series entitled Asia's Unknown Uprisings. Dr. Katsifikas, it's a pleasure to be speaking with you.
Thank you for inviting me.
How would you describe the Eros Effect?
Well, history is normally written about great men and great women and major events like wars and catastrophes that occur. And the Eros Effect is a way to try to understand history through the power of love, through the power of human solidarity, through the emergence of hundreds of thousands and millions of people as actors, as shapers of history. The most recent example, I think, is the Arab Spring and the Occupy movement, which overnight, out of nowhere, involving millions of people from the grassroots, has really changed the discourse in the world. We now talk about the 1% and the 99%. We now understand the limits of many of the U.S.-imposed regimes in the Arab world, and also ones that the U.S. opposed. Through millions of people acting without leaders, without any party, without central organization, history has been changed. So the Eros Effect refers to these moments when suddenly, without any organization or leader calling for it, millions of people go into the streets and change history. They massively occupy public space. They refuse to go home. They change their everyday lives. They live according to different norms and values than previously. So instead of living according to the values of just doing your job and making money and doing the best you can, all of a sudden, hundreds of thousands of people said, we're going to occupy city squares around the world and talk about the need for a better social system, better economic system than capitalism, than corporate capitalism, than the finance capital run system that we have today. How does that occur? It's a very interesting process. So the Eros Effect tries to speak to that and say that that phenomenon in history occurs much more often than we understand. And in fact, is one of the great resources that social change initiatives can draw upon. I first was able to articulate the notion of the Eros Effect when I had a eureka moment after spending years researching what had happened in the 1960s. And as I specifically looked at notes that I had taken in four languages in terms of what had happened at different demonstrations, what had motivated the demonstrations, where had they come from, I came to understand that specific movement events in different parts of the world had stimulated people in other parts of the world to act, and that people acted more in response to social movements, uprisings, than they had to national, political, or economic conditions. What do I mean by that? Well, specifically, the Tet Offensive and the Vietnamese heroic resistance to American imperial domination led to the Tet Offensive in 1968, when every major American base overnight had surprise attacks launched on it. At that very same time, there was a student conference in Berlin, Germany, in West Berlin, that activists from many parts of Europe attended in solidarity with the Vietnamese struggle. That conference inspired students, especially from France, who went back to France and became involved in the March 22nd movement and helped spark what's called the May events, May 68 in France, when there was a near revolution. The near revolution in France in May 68 stimulated general strikes as far away as Senegal and Spain. Germany experienced its worst crisis since World War II. A major uprising, emergency laws were passed. The movements in Mexico were stimulated by what had happened in France, as of course were movements around the world, including at Columbia University in 1968. In Mexico, students were inspired by the French uprising, and they organized against the Olympics, which were there in 1968. And the Mexican authorities used overwhelming force, killing some 400 Mexican students at Tlatelolco Plaza in 1968. So, I mean, we could go on and on, but I think it's fair to say that those events were all related to each other much more than they were related to any specifically national, political, or economic condition. And when I realized that that had been the reason for these uprisings, I hit upon the concept of Eros because as a friend and student of Herbert Marcuse, whose writings about Eros and civilization were so important to me, I struggled with coming to name this phenomenon that I had now seen, now witnessed. And a friend of mine, Rick Nadeau, helped me name it the Eros effect in that moment where I was saying, the Eros phenomenon, and he said, what about Eros effect? I said, that's it, we'll call it Eros effect. And that's what I've called it ever since. Now, since 1968, I detect five other outbreaks of this phenomenon where hundreds of thousands or millions of people go into the streets without central organization to try to realize greater freedom. So one would be the disarmament movement of the 1970s and early 1980s. When suddenly, without warning, millions of people were in the streets of Europe and the United States demanding an end to the Cold War and to the Soviet Union and American threat to wipe out the world through nuclear war. And, you know, the disarmament movement culminates in the end of the Cold War with Gorbachev's surrender to the West, essentially. It was, in fact, according to his memoirs, the millions of people who protested, especially in Germany, that convinced him that the West was not going to invade Russia again and that the buffer states in Eastern Europe, which the Soviet Union had constructed at the end of World War II, were no longer needed. So it was the protesters who helped change history in that period. The second episode of the Eros effect is what I've written my most recent book about, the Asia's Unknown Uprisings. We have volume one in hand on Korea, but volume two deals with uprisings in nine other places. The Philippines in 1986, which overthrew the dictatorship of Ferdinand Marcos, has inspired us with the words people power, which of course has much earlier attributes in the Black Panther Party's slogan, all power to the people. But there was a string of uprisings that occurred again without central organization. So when we look at the world, 86 in the Philippines, 87 in South Korea, 88 in Burma, 89 in Tibet and in China, 90 in Bangladesh, in Nepal and Taiwan, 92 in Thailand, 98 in Indonesia. All of these movements in one form or another identified as people power movements. They were all not led by political parties. They were all spontaneous, in some form or another, grassroots attempts to overthrow local dictatorships. And they were very successful in doing so. Not always. In China, in Burma, in other places, there was no success. In other, you know, in Indonesia, the Philippines, for instance, South Korea, there was success in a democratic transition that led to the imposition of neoliberal policies. We can talk about that in a moment. The third outbreak of the Eros effect in this period would be in 1989 with the overthrow of the Soviet regimes and the Eros effect in Eastern Europe, which was predated and influenced by the Asian movements that I was just talking about. The fourth is the wave of anti or alter globalization struggles that is most famously known as the Battle of Seattle in 1999, but which has a much earlier provenance and which, you know, goes back to the 1970s with anti-IMF food riots in Africa and Latin America. In 1987 in Venezuela, hundreds of people were killed, rising against the IMF's austerity measures there. There were protests in Berlin, Germany in 1988 that compelled the bankers of the world to adjourn early. So 11 years before Seattle in Berlin, Germany, there were similar protests that similarly compelled the world's bankers to close up shop. But this culminates in a wave of elite summits being confronted from the IMF, World Bank, G8, Davos, Switzerland gathering of the world economic elite. You know, there was a period around the year 2000, 2001, where all of these events were continually being protested by hundreds of thousands, tens of thousands, or more people. And finally, of course, with the Arab Spring and the Occupy movement, we see, again, grassroots people by the hundreds of thousands, by the millions, making history. Most historians write these events out of history. Their accounts are about great men, great women, about wars, about catastrophes and disasters. So I'm part of what, you know, in South Korea is called Minjong history, people's history. And, you know, Howard Zinn sort of pioneered this in the United States. And we're trying to understand history based upon ordinary people's aspirations, dreams, and accomplishments through struggles in the streets.
Another part that's written out of these histories is the... Oftentimes when I hear about people talking about people's histories and people movements' histories, it doesn't necessarily... It frames them within the certain style of like Otpor, of these mass movements that are nonviolent and resistance, very Gandhian. But you make a point of talking about how in Gwangju and in like other uprisings that happened, there were actually armed resistance and people took many different means to sort of enact the Eros effect and try to liberate themselves. Can you talk about that?
Well, Gwangju is a very special case because the citizens of Gwangju and of that surrounding region, the Chola province, today divided into North Chola, South Chola, and Jeju, into three provinces actually, in South Korea, have a long history of resisting central authority. The Jeju Women Divers, matrifocal anarchistic organization. In South Chola, there was, you know, 1,000 years ago or so, there was a slave uprising, and a vast swath of Chola was liberated and had a free republic in which slaves were freed themselves, and people could choose whatever profession they wanted, could live however they wanted, and they survived until they were ultimately overwhelmed by the Showa dynasty, which conquered all of the Korean Peninsula and ruled it for centuries thereafter. So there's a long tradition of the dissident intellectuals from Seoul being exiled to the Chola region and having, you know, schools in which they brought up young scholars to think likewise about freedom, about autonomy, about local self-governance. So that in the period of the American-imposed dictatorships in South Korea, the upside was that the U.S. economy was able to help build up South Korea into an industrial power, which the Japanese had also done in Northern Korea. Left out of that development in South Korea, however, was the southwestern portion of the country where the Cholas are located. It was the corridor from Seoul to Busan that was built up, and the Cholas remained largely agricultural, so that the communitarian values of the past remained more or less intact in the Cholas. Then, you know, in 1979, Park Chung-hee, the Korean dictator, was assassinated by his own CIA chief, the KCIA chief. And Koreans uniformly thought, my goodness, the time has come for democracy again in South Korea. Within a couple of months, a new general seized power in South Korea, Chun Doo-hwan, on December 12, 1979. When the spring came and students began protesting against Chun, he basically said, after 100,000 students protested in Seoul, if you go back into the streets, I'm going to use the military against you. Students met in Seoul and decided to call off their demonstrations. The only place in South Korea that students went back into the streets was in Gwangju. And the military, the American commanders in South Korea agreed to release crack paratroopers from the front lines with North Korea to be used against the people of Gwangju. They went in with utmost brutality, bayoneting students, defenseless students, raping women, stripping people naked, herding them like cattle into the backs of trucks. Cab drivers who stopped to aid students who had been bayoneted were killed by the military. The police chief of Gwangju refused to order his men to go along with what the military was doing. He was taken away and tortured in Seoul. The commanding general of the local military, General Chung Eung, three times refused to order his men to open fire, even though he received orders from Seoul telling him to tell his men to use live ammunition. Special forces landed behind his lines and took him away. So the people of the Cholas rose up as one and, in a few days of fighting, drove the military out of the city. This is a military that was, you know, terribly bloody, had killed dozens of people. At the time, Human Rights Watch counted 3,000 dead. We'll never know how many people died. In any event, what's remarkable is that, first of all, the students began the uprising, but when the fighting became very intense, the military was using flamethrowers, machine guns, helicopters on civilians. Hundreds of thousands of people were remaining in the streets. There was a moment when defeat seemed to be coming, and at that moment, in the back of the mammoth crowd, honking could be heard, and as the honking came closer, as people parted so that the honkers could come through, it was a dozen big buses and over 100 taxis who had formed a procession and went up against the military with trucks and buses. Citizens set fire to vehicles and drove them into the ranks of the military. The military held control that night. The next day at 1 p.m., when 100,000 or more citizens gathered on the central plaza and the military was arrayed across the street, the national anthem blared and the military opened fire, killing dozens more people. At that moment, people raided the National Guard armory. They raided police stations. Many policemen took off their uniforms and joined the protesters, and they drove the military out of the city by that evening in an armed confrontation that ended the violence in Gwangju. That remarkable occurrence brought an end to crime in the city. The military surrounded the city. Citizens shared food, and citizens governed themselves through direct democracy, meeting in groups of 50 to 150,000 downtown Gwangju in front of the province hall in a circular area, a traffic circle today, where there is a fountain. They use the fountain, the circular fountain, as the stage, and anyone was allowed to speak. The differences were tolerated. You can imagine the older, distinguished community citizens, businessmen, politicians stood up and said, this is crazy. We should surrender all our weapons. We're all going to be killed. The younger, more militant activists stood up and said, the reason we picked up these weapons is because we were being killed. The military should apologize. The military should compensate the families of the dead and pay for the hospital bills for the wounded. and Chun Duhuan should be imprisoned for crimes for having sent the military in here. Well, they reached a compromise. They sent, I think, 3,000 guns. It's in my book. This is all in the book. They sent 3,000 guns on some of the captured trucks to the military. The military released dozens of prisoners. The rallies continued. I should mention that the largest employer in Gwangju, then called Asia Motors, today Kia, the workers, almost to the man, supported the uprising, not only in words. They stopped work and they delivered to the uprising dozens of brand new vehicles, including about 15 armored trucks that they had built. So very interestingly, you had the people who built armored cars driving those cars and using them to drive the military out of the city. The workers from that factory also brought their heavy equipment downtown and cleared out the streets of the rubble of the fighting, the burnt out hulks of vehicles and other, you know, you can imagine this, the streets were a mess. Buildings had been burnt. The labor office was burnt. The tax office was burnt. Very scientifically selected buildings had been burnt. The media office, NBC was burnt because it had reported falsely that citizens were rioting and that the military had killed no one, that it was remaining, you know, above the fray as these communists and rioters in Gwangju went into the streets. So the citizens of Gwangju responded after they drove the military out by forming what's been called the Beautiful Community. You know, they shared food, they cleaned up the streets together, they made decisions democratically. The high school girls came forward without anyone asking. They picked up the corpses, they cleaned them, they assembled them in a martial arts studio near the province hall so that families could come and identify them. When nurses and doctors put out the call for blood, saying we don't have enough blood, hundreds of people rushed to the hospitals to give blood, not for money, just to give blood, voluntarily. Even the city's mafia, the two gangs, came to some of these meetings at Province Hall and swore allegiance to the people's uprising. It was the whole city's truly remarkable event. The city, United Prostitutes said this was the first time they felt as full and equal citizens of the city of Gwangju. So, you know, this type of occurrence embodies a form of the Eros effect, people's love and solidarity with each other, that is most important, and I see very, you know, important to the future of human civilization, because it shows the remarkable capacity that people have for self-government and self-organization. This 20th century has produced knowledge of the universe that is far beyond what people have had in the past. I mean, any third grader could tell you today the world is round and goes around the sun. You know, Galileo and Copernicus had to struggle to make those very facts known to people. I mean, you know, in Europe. But the fact is, ordinary citizens today are capable of self-government, and it's shown time and again in places like Gwangju. So, you know, we see in Gwangju, I think, the future of humanity.
What have been the effects, the lasting effects of the Beautiful Community on current Korean culture and current concepts of struggle in South Korea?
Well, after the uprising, when the U.S. essentially ordered the South Korean military in, dozens more were killed, so-called order was restored, and 7 long years of repression, more than 7, but 7 particularly harsh years of repression ensued. The Chun Doo-hwan government sent over 300,000 of its own citizens to re-education camps. Many people died. Many were physically disfigured for the rest of their lives from beatings and torture. And anyone who tried to talk about the Gwangju uprising was arrested. Many people committed suicide, calling for the truth about Gwangju to be known. In 1985, a book finally appeared about Gwangju. The military confiscated hundreds of thousands of copies of it, but it kept being reprinted. And once the cat was out of the bag, students again took the lead in protesting, demanding that the U.S. acknowledge its role in the suppression of the Gwangju uprising, demanding that the South Korean government talk about what really had happened in Gwangju. And in 1987, finally, the various opposition groups were able to organize a nationwide uprising against the military dictatorship. 19 consecutive days of hundreds of thousands of people illegally taking to the streets. On the very first day, June 10th, 1987, so many people went into the streets that they overwhelmed the riot police in Seoul. They captured them, took away their weapons, took away their uniforms, and burned them in the streets, the tear gas guns, the masks, the helmets, the clubs. And of course, the military police were called in and the counterattacks, but for 19 days this went on. In the course of the 19 days, the United States government changed its position from Chun Doo-hwan should remain in power to, well, maybe it's time for a democratic transition, as these people are calling for. And on June 29th, Chun stepped aside and permitted direct presidential elections, the release of thousands of prisoners, and promised greater liberty, which occurred. And South Korea is today a democracy, largely because of the Gwangju uprising and the June uprising, whose main slogan was, "Remember Gwangju." The culture of South Korea has also really sent a what's so-called Korean wave around the world of pop music and movies and TV shows. Now, many of those producers, directors, actors have been banned from, let's say, participating under the military government in any cultural production. So once South Korea liberalized, these very talented people whose talents have been, let's say, in an incubator waiting to explode, exploded onto the world stage. I don't know if you've seen any of the South Korean television dramas, multi-part, and I watched one that was 53, about that slave revolt in the Cholas called the Haitian, what's the English translation? Oh, my goodness. Emperor of the Sea? Emperor of the Sea, I think, is the Haitian. So these are magnificent productions that show a civil society, a traditional form of civil society that is very developed and has social relations that are important beyond those of the relations to the state, to the government. Much as we look back at Greek tragedy and understand that, Antigone defied the king by burying her brother's body when the king had ordered her brother's body to rot and be eaten by the dogs. She buried the body and for that took her own life rather than be subject to the authority of the state. Well, this is a recurrent theme in Korean drama, in Korean culture. And you have the Pansori Chunhyang from the South Chola region, North Chola actually, from what is today North Chola, in Namwon, where she refuses the advances of the new, city ruler appointed by the emperor and insists upon her own ability to choose the man she wants to be with. And, is beaten to within a hair of her life until the man that she has been waiting for is able to return and depose the ruler that has been beating her, having her beaten. So, this Gwangju uprising is in a long tradition in South Korea of understanding that the state is not the final authority on justice, that in fact it's people's movements that bring about justice, not governmental edicts.
We'll return to our conversation with Dr. George Katsiafikas on his new book, Asia's Unknown Uprisings, Volume 1, South Korean Social Movements in the 20th Century, after a short break. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Final Straw. Let's continue our conversation with Dr. George Katsiafikas on his new book, Asia's Unknown Uprisings, Volume 1, South Korean Social Movements in the 20th Century. As far as a focus on the state, Korea has a long history of anarchist organizations, an area of interest to me. Can you talk about that philosophy and how it was able to mesh with shamanistic and Tong, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing this right, but Tonghak systems or belief systems? And also, how does Korean popular culture currently presenting those histories in terms of nationalism and liberation?
Those are big issues. Jason Adams has written about non-Western forms of anarchism, and Korean indigenous forms of social organization and civil society are excellent examples of this phenomenon. I mentioned the women divers of Jeju. These were women who, without oxygen tanks, fins, masks, or wetsuits, traditionally fed the families and were the main source of the island's economy because of the rich and abundant sea life in the reefs around the island. They had their own form of organization that would admit new members based upon applications and based upon knowing the families of the persons, and made sure that everyone on the island had enough to eat. Jeju's, you know, to this day, people say no thieves, no beggars, no locked doors. What it means is that, the people take care of each other. There's a mutual aid, a form of mutual aid that they're very proud of. Now, that particular form was so threatening to the United States when the United States moved to divide Korea, that the refusal of the people of Jeju to participate in the elections that the United States called just for the southern part of the island, the southern part of the peninsula of Korea, to install a government in South Korea. People in Jeju wanted Korea to remain unified, and they refused to vote. Many people in Jeju, it's a long story, but the sad fact is that from 1947 to 1952, at least 30,000 people on the island of Jeju were massacred, innocent civilians. The majority of the island was rounded up into what would later be called strategic hamlets in Vietnam. But the island's population was only about 150,000, and at least 30,000 of those people were killed under the auspices of a U.S. military government and a South Korean government that had signed over its military authority to the United States. Now, this massacre is not well known, and it has left Jeju society, civil society, still wounded and trying to rebuild. In the Japanese occupation earlier in South Korea, brutal form, perhaps not as brutal in Jeju as United States rule was, but a very brutal occupation and colonization occurred. Korea was made a part of the greater Japanese Empire. Queen Min was gang raped and killed, her body burned by Japanese ninja led by a Harvard graduate. And soon thereafter, the United States and South Korea, the United States and Japan, signed a secret memorandum of understanding, the Taft-Katsura agreement, so-called, in 1905, that was kept secret for decades, that gave Japan control of Korea in exchange for American control of the Philippines, spheres of influence in Asia. Japanese colonization of Korea meant that more than 100,000 women were taken as sex slaves for the emperor's army. Millions of people were shipped to Japan to work in the mines and factories of Japan. Hundreds of thousands of Korean men were put into the Japanese military. And if you wanted to resist Japanese colonization, your best shot was to leave Korea and fight against the Japanese in Manchuria or elsewhere. So in Manchuria, thousands of Koreans grew to tens of thousands of Koreans, grew to hundreds of thousands of Koreans fighting against the Japanese in China. among those Manchurian Koreans arose a tremendous anarchist organization of cooperatives and even armed units that fought the Japanese. The history of that entire effort is not well known, not even in Korea today. It's certainly not well known in North Korea. And in South Korea, there's at least one new book out about it, which I have not had a chance to look at. So that this history is only now emerging as in details. And, you know, much of what happened appears to be that the Stalinists first united with these anarchists to fight against the Japanese and then launched an attack on the anarchists that more or less wiped them out. That shouldn't be surprising to people as much as it's upsetting, because very similar type of events occurred in Spain, as we know better, for instance, from Ken Loach's movie Land and Freedom, in terms of the role that these, you know, Stalinists played in wiping the anarchists out.
You mentioned the struggles and suppression in Jeju, and Jeju City is currently the sister city to Santa Rosa, California, which is home to KWTF, which is one of the stations rebroadcasting this show. There's also currently the U.S. government with the South Korean government are trying to build a naval base on Jeju Island that's facing a lot of resistance from the population there. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. In the aftermath of the democracy movement in South Korea, the people of Jeju watched as the people of Gwangju won the right to protest openly against the government. And in fact, Chun Doo-hwan and Roh Tae-woo were imprisoned and a special law enacted. So Jeju citizens also got a special law enacted that gave them immunity for coming forth and testifying about the massacre that occurred in 1948. Believe it or not, there were still people who had difficulties testifying 50 years later, and even after the special law was enacted. So the president of South Korea, 10 years later, you know, at the end of 2007, as I recall, Noh Moo-hyun went to Jeju and officially apologized for the massacre and named the island a peace island and promised that it would never again be used as a military base and that war would never again visit Jeju. Now, Noh Moo-hyun's term in office ended, he retired, and the neoconservative administration that replaced him launched a counteroffensive against many of the gains of the democracy movement. For instance, one of the things they did was to name the Jeju uprising of April 3rd, 1948 as communist, and therefore not part of the democracy movement, and therefore not to be considered above immunity. And furthermore, then the Lee Myung-bak government, this new neoconservative government, decided to build a giant naval base in Jeju to serve as a frontline base in the United States attempt to surround China. And with U.S. encouragement and support, they have begun dynamiting the coral reefs around a small part of the island, Kangjong Village, whose citizens overwhelmingly oppose the construction of this base. Their struggle has proceeded nonviolently for several years now. They have been imprisoned, they have been beaten, they have been gassed. Just 10 days ago, a priest was pushed off of a high platform or fell off of a high platform in a scuffle with riot police and injured severely, broke his back. This effort to stop the base has resonated very well with celebrities like Robert Redford and Gloria Steinem. Many activists from around the world have supported the people of Kangjong and of Jeju in seeking to stop the naval base. And it remains a question. Interestingly, in South Korea, as I think in China, believe it or not, there is a way in which civil society and citizens' protests can alter government policy much more easily than here in the United States. And it's my feeling that if the citizens of Jeju persist in their protests and continue to receive international support, there is a chance, maybe even a good chance, that this naval base will never open. So this is it's a critical moment not only for the people of Jeju, not only for South Korea, because the military budget and the division system, the division of the peninsula, the U.S. encouragement of the potential threat posed by North Korea, all of that really is to the detriment of South Korea. It saps its budget, wasteful spending on the military. But to the world, as we see what can only be understood as a new Cold War being constructed by the United States in its overestimation of the Chinese military threat, in its attempts to surround China with bases. And these are obviously leading nowhere good. This is an obvious problem that one needs to nip in the bud. And so the struggle in Jeju is a very important struggle for humanity's future. I know Jeju well, and as you said earlier, I really do love South Korea, and the people of Jeju are especially compassionate and in need of support. They suffered terribly in the massacres that were, after all, condoned, organized, and supported by the United States government, the military government, from 1945 to 1948, and thereafter by the South Korean government that the United States set up, which had secretly signed over operational control of its military to the United States. So really, the massacres in Jeju that were so horrendous were done by the United States. Believe it or not, it was not until 1997, almost 50 years later, that the first public event in the United States occurred that talked about these massacres.
And there was over 30,000 people who were massacred, right?
Officially, according to the South Korean government, 34,000 and more. Many people say it could be as many as 70 or 80,000 people who were massacred. I mean, they recently were expanding the new runway at Jeju Airport, found so many corpses they had to call it off and exhume the bodies to get them out of there. So there's just bodies literally everywhere. And of course, many of the bodies were dumped into the sea. So we'll never know how many people were annihilated in that attempt to bring the island under U.S. control.
Okay. What kind of position would you say that people who are in the sister city, who are in Northern California, would be? What kind of effect can they have on the struggle in Jeju for an end to this military base expansion?
Well, I think that one thing that people could do is to go there and just bring physically with them the energy that they have against the military. Jeju, after all, is a beautiful island. It's got a big volcano in the center, Mount Hawa, palm trees around it, and is known in South Korea by many people as Honeymoon Island. It's a great destination to go. And if you're going in solidarity with the people who are struggling, you're not going as a tourist. So it would be a unique opportunity for people to go, show solidarity, and understand something about South Korea and about Korea, about Asia, and to contribute to this worldwide struggle against U.S. militarism and the emergence of a new Cold War. So the other things that people, I'm sure, are already doing in Northern California are writing letters, petitions, possibly having public events where they invite artists in particular from Jeju who have been outspoken and vocal in the movement against the naval base, or to invite other people from Jeju to come to the United States. I think it's a great way for people from Jeju to see that they have the support internationally that would then inspire them and strengthen them in their struggles in the future. And those are just, I think, some of the ways. I think, I don't know the products that Santa Rosa produces, but I would think even symbolic acts like sending a case of wine to the residents of, you know, Kangjong who are fighting would have great symbolic significance there. I don't know if you remember the story of how the people in Occupy Wall Street in New York all of a sudden had pizzas delivered to them, and there was a note saying it was from their fellow citizens in Cairo who were sending the pizzas, who had called up and ordered pizza for them. Had a great electric effect on people. These erotic bonds, these ties of solidarity and love across borders play very important roles in helping to strengthen social movements.
So although your second volume hasn't come out and you've talked a bit about the string of uprisings in the late 80s and onward in Philippines, Burma, Tibet, China, Taiwan, Nepal, Bangladesh, Thailand, and Indonesia, you also do make a point in it of paralleling the Arab Spring with the Occupy movement. I know we don't have that much time and it's a big subject. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, yes, I see these upsurges as related to each other and, you know, involving this phenomenon I call the Eros effect. The very significant thing about the Asian uprisings in terms of the future of the global movement is that the Asian uprisings succeeded in deposing what the U.S. media and European media called crony capitalism. People like Ferdinand Marcos or Suharto, who appropriated for themselves tens of billions of dollars. What they're being thrown out did, however, was open the door for giant U.S. and Japanese banks and corporations to have access to capital and labor markets that they had previously been denied, so that neoliberalism and capitalism, global capitalism, expanded into the vacuum left by the overthrow of these local dictators. In my view, this provides the basis, the material basis, for a unified global movement in the 21st century. In Africa and Latin America, in the 20th century, already the struggle against American imperialism, neoliberalism, European imperialism were very pronounced. In East Asia, in these uprisings I described, the struggle was more often against local dictatorships and crony capitalists, as they were called. So now that the Asian movement has gone through this phase and neoliberalism has become pervasively imposed, the struggle against global capitalism will unite Asia, Africa, and Latin America, and with progressive activists in the North, in Europe and North America, into a unified global movement that might have the chance to overthrow global capitalism and create a system based on local autonomy, local control, and participatory democracy, genuine democracy, not the sham they call democracy that involves voting for the best candidate that millionaires can buy every 4 years.
Well, Dr. Katsiafikas, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much.
We've been speaking with Dr. George Katsiafikas on his new book, Asia's Unknown Uprisings, Volume 1, South Korean Social Movements in the 20th Century, available through PM Press. For more materials by Dr. Katsiafikas, check out his website at eroseffect.com. Asheville Free Media, ashevillefm.org. This has been The Final Straw, and I'm your host, Bursa Goodness. The Final Straw can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, and KWTF in Santa Rosa, California. This show is brought to you by the worker owners at Firestorm Books and Cafe at 48 Commerce Street in downtown Asheville, North Carolina, featuring organic coffee and milks, vegan sandwiches and wraps, homemade baked goods, radical literature, and a community calendar that can be found at www.firestormcafe.com. Have a great week. Yeah.
아름다운 이곳에 자랑스러운 곳에 살리라. 찬란하게 빛나는 내가 있고 내가 있네.